Welcome to the Money Tree Investing Podcast. Stock market, wealth, personal finance, value stocks. Invest in your life.
Welcome to this week's episode of Money Tree Investing Podcast. We're happy to have you joining us here for this exciting show. My name is Kirk Chisholm, and I'll be your host. Today, we're going to be talking about stock trading lessons learned from a school teacher who turned into a $50 million entrepreneur. His name is Jason Bond. Now, I'm not talking about James Bond. This is maybe his distant cousin. We'll find out. But I'm really excited to dig into some of his Wall Street secrets. But before we get to Jason, let's hear from our sponsor. So are you looking for a better way to invest during market turmoil? Consider Betterment. Betterment is a robo-advisor that uses time-tested principles of modern portfolio theory to help you manage your wealth and reach your financial goals. With Betterment, you don't have to worry about what the market's doing on a day-to-day basis. Instead, Betterment allows you to use the stock market to consistently build wealth. For more information, visit moneytreepodcast.com/Betterment. A lot of investors use Betterment, but it doesn't mean it's the right fit for you. Do your own research. Check out moneytreepodcast.com/Betterment to see if Betterment is the right fit for you. So today we're interviewing Jason Bond. How are you doing today, Jason?
Great. Thanks for having me here, Kirk.
If none of you have heard of Jason before, he's a really successful investor and business owner. Tell us a bit about your backstory. I think it's probably better coming from you than me.
Yeah, you bet. So it's kind of an interesting one, but I assume probably similar to most entrepreneurs. I was a school teacher in upstate New York for 10 years, and probably around my seventh year as a school teacher, I started to get the itch to have more money. I was doing my taxes. My wife was also a school teacher, so we had our W-2s, and I was punching them into TurboTax. And that particular year, TurboTax came with a free copy of Quicken. And it kind of spit out all of our financials. And one of the things that it spit out was net worth. And I honestly didn't know what net worth meant. Probably common sense to most listeners. But again, school teacher, master's degree, coaching sports, just not something I ever thought about. Took on a ton of student loans, credit cards, etc., as did my wife. And there was just this red number there inside of parentheses. It was bold and it said minus $250,000. And I thought, whoa, yeah, I don't know what that is, but it's definitely not green. It can't be good. And I started to research what net worth was and realized we didn't have one. We always carried a few thousand dollars in the bank account. My wife, also a school teacher, master's degree, paid for these things as we went. We took student loans as necessary, got a small mortgage on a house, personal loans, credit cards, car loans, and all of that added up to just no net worth. And I quickly realized the potential to have a net worth was really far out based on our income, our costs, our expenses, etc. So I started to pursue the idea of paying off that debt, which was overwhelming. That kind of led me to the debt snowball concept with Dave Ramsey. And it made sense to my wife and I. So we started to pursue that around my sixth or seventh year of teaching. She was in her third or fourth year of teaching. And that's the route we took. And that kind of led me to everything else.
That's amazing. So I find it fascinating that you start as a school teacher, which I think probably we all know they don't make much money, considering probably what they should be making, but certainly the lower end of the income scale.
Yeah.
And you've built this enormous business. Can you tell us a little bit about how you went from being a teacher into this big mindset shift?
All right, so I'm doing the debt snowball thing, and that meant teaching during the day. I would coach, let's take, for example, fall season. I would teach during the day, coach boys and girls varsity cross country for a salary after the school day was over. And then I would announce the high school football game after that, or do some sort of supervision during the football games or any other fall sports. So my day was teaching, coaching, supervision. And after the stadium would close down, I would pull cans out of the garbage cans, put plastic gloves on, dump the cans, pull the cans out, fight the bees off. I remember one time my wife got stung because I would recruit her to come up with me and pull cans as well. And she's like, seriously, Jay, like this is what we have to do? We were doing the Dave Ramsey debt snowball and just tackling the smallest credit card. And that process of my wife being disappointed there, but doing everything I could within the day to make money and pay down debt, led me to start to pursue things that would make me more money. I eventually got into running my own roofing business during the summers. And that was good because I could make a good chunk of money in the summers. I would run my own camps and clinics and really be aggressive with them. And I was starting to make good chunks of money doing that. And the stock market naturally came past my agenda or my screen at some point in time. I don't remember quite exactly how, but I had a teaching colleague who was into stock trading. And I think that's really how I stumbled into it. And I wasn't good at it or anything like that, but I thought, wow, okay, stock trading, maybe this is the ticket. And as I was studying stock trading, I was noticing that there were businesses built around teaching people to trade stocks. And I thought, my goodness, maybe this is it for me. Now, at the time, I was studying to be a principal. I thought, okay, if I could be a school principal, I could make more money. They make much more than teachers. Work year-round, but they make much more than teachers. So maybe I'll do that. So I'm doing my second master's, and I'm watching these people teach people to trade stocks. And I get this idea that, hey, I have a master's in education. I'm closing in on a decade of doing this. I'm a good coach. I know how to teach. What if I learn something new with infinite upside? Like a principal, you're still capped by a salary. So maybe instead of being a principal, I learn how to trade stocks and I teach other people how to trade stocks. And so it was the process of paying down debt that led me to trying to figure out how to make money faster to pay that debt off. And that process there led me to stock trading. And then that led me to realizing, wow, people make a lot of money teaching people to trade stocks. All I have to do is be an amazing trader. I'm already a great teacher. I could do this. Now, it turned out becoming a good stock trader was a lot harder than I had anticipated. And that led me to finding my now business partner, Jeff Bishop. And he taught me how to trade, seeded me with trading accounts. And I went through this 3-year journey of learning how to be a proficient stock trader. And once I did that, the doors really opened for me because I like to work. I like to make money. I resigned that teaching job and launched a business called Jason Bond Picks. And really what it was I would teach people how to make money trading stocks, and specifically stocks under $10. So we call those small caps, market caps under $2 billion. And I was swing trading them. So I buy them on a Monday, I try and get profit by a Friday. And I got good at this. And people got really excited about doing it with me. And there my business started to take off in that moment.
What year did you start in this? Because obviously trends have a big impact on people's success. When did you start?
I bought my first house in about 2005, closing in on the height of the real estate market. It was a really rough house. So around 2008, the market, of course, broke. That was the real estate bubble. By 2011, I had realized I need to leave my teaching career. So I taught in a New York State public school from 2001 to 2011. I was really scared to leave. But by then, we were a few years into the debt snowball. We actually sold our house and moved back into an apartment, sold our nicer cars and got garbage cars. I would refer to them as garbage cars, cars that, you know, like the engine block could seize up on you if you drove it a little bit too fast type thing.
The beaters.
All to pay down debt so I could take the risk of being a stock trader and teaching other people how to trade stocks. So I got into this around 2011, 2012. There have been ups and downs in that time period, but it's certainly been a bull market. So that's helped.
And I think it's great. We had Jeff on in a prior episode, which is great. I really enjoyed the interview with him as well.
Yeah.
So, I mean, he's more options based and you're more stock based. So can you kind of talk a little bit about what you do from a stock perspective? Like, how do you go about your strategy?
It's really two things. And I boil it down to chart patterns, and the only two patterns that I play are crashing stocks, and I call them rockets. So I refer to the two patterns as rockets, which we could refer to as a breakout, and then crashing stocks, which I tell people on a chart looks like a fish hook. So I'm looking for the extremes on small caps, and then I'm playing after the information is kind of calculated in, which is often an overreaction. Stocks have great news. Small company, let's say Blue Apron right now. I'm actually in this stock. It's at about 73 cents. Like, everybody knows Blue Apron, the meal kit company, and they probably don't know that they're struggling immensely right now to be profitable. So the stock is just crashing and crashing and crashing, and there's fears of bankruptcy. And often there's an overreaction when a company is doing horrible. Like, Blue Apron just IPO'd a few years ago, I believe, and it's just been straight down since because they don't make money. They spend a ton of money. And in those overreactions, especially when there's a very acute one in a short period of time, I try and come in and play what I call a bounce or a fish hook, nothing more than a whipsaw. So I take into consideration there's overreaction, there's fear, there's panic, and that drives the selling to abnormally low levels. And then often you get a whipsaw or a bounce, and it's in that bounce that I make good money. And then I do the same thing with the overreaction. You know, company has great news, stock skyrockets a few 100%. Once it settles down for a few days, I'll play a Fibonacci retracement in there. So I'm just looking for rockets and fish hooks or breakouts and breakdowns. And I'm usually trying to make money off of either overreactions to the upside or overreactions to the downside. And it's been very profitable for me. And listen, it happens all the time on stocks under 10, Kirk, because these stocks are smaller companies. So the market capitalization of 100 million to 2 billion. So they're smaller companies. They have great news all the time. So there's these overreactions to the upside. And then they have horrible news all the time because they're generally not profitable. So there's overreactions to the downside. And so if I could boil my service down into one word, it's emotion. I make my money off of emotion, either to the upside or to the downside.
I mean, it sounds to me like you're doing a lot of reversion to the mean. Is that kind of an accurate statement?
Exactly. Counter trend trading is what I do. So when everybody's super excited about the stock screaming higher, I know sooner or later that's going to peter out and crash. Once it crashes, it usually has a secondary move higher. I call it a rest and retest pattern. So counter trend. And then counter trend on the downside, just a washout to the downside and a bounce. So when everybody's panicking, I try and wait for the height of that panic and buy and then make money in the next week when it reverses.
You mentioned emotion, and that's a huge part of investing. If you look at fear and greed, those are really the only two emotions that matter.
Yeah.
You know, when it comes to investing. So how do you, I've talked to a number of traders, number of really legendary ones I've had on the show. How do you stay in control of your emotions? It's an emotional game. You're basically fighting against yourself. That's the biggest battle. Like, how do you maintain control yourself?
Yeah, the best thing that I've found for me, and I swing trade. So day trading is, you know, buying and selling same day. And, you know, I'm growing the business, Raging Bull in general. So that's kind of like my full-time thing and my main source of income. And then to kind of drive that machine, I have to be a good stock trader. So my side hustle is swing trading. And that's kind of what I've built my teaching around. And that's, you know, where you're looking to buy and sell stocks in a few days, a few weeks, or a few months. So with that strategy for me, I find the emotion boils down to technical analysis. You really can't do a lot of fundamental research on a company if you're only holding it for a few days to a few weeks. You would know the catalysts, of course, by reading the headlines and know when their earnings are coming up and whatnot. But in general, it's mostly based on technical analysis. So to manage emotions, I find that so long as I follow what I'm seeing on the charts and don't allow my ego or my intuition to get in the way of what the market is saying based on the price action, then I do okay. It's where I think I know more than Wall Street about a particular stock after it's broken the pattern that I'm supposed to be following that my fear and greed come into play. And so by following the technical analysis and really sticking to that 99% of the time, I am able to keep those emotions in check. They certainly come into play for every trader. But as long as you're, for me, my system is based on those two patterns, a rocket or a fish hook. There's more details involved, Fibonacci retracement and oversold condition. But in general, as long as I stick to my rules within those two patterns, then I'm able to keep emotion out. Sometimes that gets away from me, but for the most part, that's been where I've been successful. And I've trained a lot of people to go on to make a lot of money. And the number one thing I see in the people who make a lot of money after I train them, they do that as well. They stick to the base hits, they stick to their rules, and they just do it consistently, whether it be somebody who's gone on to be a proficient day trader or an options trader or a small cap swing trader like me. What I have found out of the most successful traders that I've trained is they are very consistent. They aim for base hits and they keep the emotions out.
So do you have any tactics you teach people for kind of managing their emotions? I know personally, I've been in the industry for 20 years and I've seen a lot. You always try to manage your emotions. And even the most experienced legendary traders, they still have this challenge. It's a human emotion. You can't really get rid of it. What are some techniques you teach people to kind of manage that?
First and foremost, and I didn't necessarily come to the table with these skills, but there's a book called Emotional Intelligence. Simply understanding what emotional intelligence is in the first place can help. I think we all have, our actions are all driven mostly by our subconscious. And I think a lot of people don't even dig into that. We're too busy. We've got kids, we have careers, trading is stressful, life is busy. Who's going to sit around and read a book about emotional intelligence? Probably nobody, unless you start to realize, wow, my emotional intelligence isn't up to speed. There's value in learning about emotional intelligence. And then like Tony Robbins talks about the application of emotional intelligence. It's one thing to know emotional intelligence. It's another to have emotional fitness. So actually practicing your intelligence is important. You can know everything you want to know about discipline and still be undisciplined. So having some rules, understanding what could cause you to break those rules. As you know, fear and greed are the two big ones. Fear and greed are huge. A lot of people get into stock trading and they just can't take a stop loss. They don't understand the concept of losing. And so I often equate it to like a baseball player. I played college baseball. I wanted to be a pro. I had a tryout with the Atlanta Braves. And I bring that up because I have a lot of experience with failure. Being a good baseball hitter means 3 out of 10 times you put that ball into play. 7 out of 10 times something goes wrong. And you can accept that because you know, on average, the best are only doing 3 out of 10. So you go up to the plate every single time with the intention of hitting the ball into play. But 7 out of 10 times, that just doesn't work out. And you can walk away knowing you're still one of the best baseball players. And people go into trading and they have no concept of what a good average should be on the win percentage side. And so they get into a trade, maybe it's to swing it across the week, and it goes against them. And then they start to justify, based on their subconscious and their inability to understand the percentages and whatnot, that this is a better long-term trade. And the stock keeps breaking down. And they're missing all of these great trading opportunities. And they're looking at a loser in their portfolio. And everything that's bad about trading starts to get pulled out of their subconscious. Fear, greed, all of these emotions. They're walking through their day miserable because they're looking at a horrible trade. So it starts by being emotionally intelligent and then practicing that, which again, Tony Robbins calls emotional fitness. These things are undervalued when it comes to trading, but if practiced, can definitely improve somebody's ability to react to what they know to be true and stay disciplined with that. And that is where I'm telling you, the most successful traders, and I've trained people who have gone on to lose all their money and people who have gone on to make millions. And I've seen everything in between, having trained tens of thousands of people. And the people who win focus on those things. They focus on being emotionally intelligent and then being emotionally fit. They stick to the rules. They try not to break them. We all get caught off guard, and how we react to that depends on how intelligent and fit we are in that category. That's just my opinion. I'm sure some other people would disagree, but if you don't have any emotional intelligence, it's hard to be a disciplined trader because your subconscious is going to take over.
Yeah, I want to kind of reiterate your point, and that's actually a great book. I've read it. It's Emotional Intelligence is, in my opinion, one of the core books that people should understand.
Yeah.
Even if you're not talking about this from an investing standpoint, even if it's just from a human standpoint, as a personal improvement, this is a great book. So how do you deal with some people make lots of money and some people don't? How do you teach people to deal with risk management? Because you touched on a point of knowing where to get in and get out in your win percentages. And I think there's a lot of people I've interviewed over the years. There are different ways to look at it. Some people have high win percentages, some have low win percentages, but it depends on how you're structuring it. There's different parts to the trading process. Can you talk about your risk management procedures and how you go about that?
Understanding one's risk tolerance. So understanding where you are with your personality. So to leave my teaching career behind, I had to accept a certain level of risk. For those in the audience that don't understand, as a teacher, you're kind of pigeonholed to the state that you work in because you get a pension at the end of 30 years. If you leave that state and go to a new state, your years don't necessarily transfer. And if they do, you have to buy them back at a heavy cost. And the pension then would go away. So leaving teaching was hard for me after a decade because I knew after 30 years, no, I wouldn't be rich, but I would have this nice annuity, if you will, or this nice pension of about $60,000 or $70,000 a year tax-free in New York State for the rest of my life. And then health benefits for the rest of my life. So no, I wasn't going to be rich, but yes, I had this really nice pension to look forward to. I had health benefits. I was safe and secure. I was doing a good job for kids. That process of putting aside 6 or 7 years of college, 10 years of real world experience, like 17 years of my life, I had to basically resign and go after something new. That required a lot of courage and a lot of risk. And once I took that initial leap, I had to calculate it in two categories. Things were either going to flop and I was going to be serving tables and bartending to try and put food on the table, or I was going to meet my expectations. What I didn't know is that I might wildly blow my expectations out of the water, and did. And so my risk tolerance over the years has grown with that confidence. I think when people get into stock trading, there's a few things that get in the way. They might not have the emotional intelligence to put into a fitness schedule. So if you don't know how to train for a marathon, you don't have the intelligence to actually train for a marathon. You might go out running every day, but it might not be the most efficient way to train for a marathon. So having emotional intelligence and understanding your risk profile allows you to kind of draw up what your trading strategy and trading routine might be. So I'll have clients come to me and they've got a $100,000 portfolio and I'll buy, let's say, Groupon stock. So it trades for, I don't know, right now around $3. And they might not know any better. And they might put all $100,000 into a $3 stock, which, you know, if you're trading under 10, you're not profitable. Your outlook isn't the best. Sure, you have wild swings and that's great, but not necessarily something you want to put all of your eggs into. And so understanding your risk tolerance, understanding the market in general, understanding the strategy in general is all required before you can put a game plan in. What I tell people when they start with me, if they have a few thousand dollars, it's very difficult to grow that into hundreds of thousands of dollars. Some people have done it, but most cannot. So the best thing to do in that scenario is to build that portfolio nest egg with your career money while you learn how to trade with something like TD Ameritrade's paper money. Once people get a reasonable size portfolio of $10,000 or $20,000, here's the risk guidelines that I give them. I think 1/2 to 1/3 on a smaller portfolio, and I consider a smaller portfolio for active trading to be around $10,000 to $20,000. That's where most of my clients come in. So they got $10,000 to $20,000, and we divide that into positions by 50% allocation or 33% allocation. So you're carrying no more than 3 trades at any given time, and you're going for a 10 to 20% return on each trade using technical analysis and defined stop losses. And if a client can get successful in that, I feel the sky is the limit. But that's kind of the risk category that I give them. I find on, let's take Groupon again, for example, on a $3 stock, it's hard to get 20% back on your money in a week. And so swing trading is a few days to a few weeks. So going for like 10 to 20% on a stock like Groupon, if you can buy it at 3 and sell it at 330 and make 10% inside of a week and then go find a similar setup and do it again, boy, oh boy, do you have a money machine that's just going to print. And so that's the trick. It exists on small caps for sure, in having some sort of risk tolerance setup in the beginning based on how comfortable you are buying Groupon at 3 and holding it overnight. Like some of my clients, they just can't stomach the fact of buying Groupon at 3 and carrying those shares overnight. So they'll try and play it from 3 to 305 because they're afraid Groupon might have bad news overnight. And it could. It's a $3 stock. I deal with all sorts of client personalities, schedules, careers, doctors, lawyers, teachers. I deal with people who are unemployed, retired. So I deal with all sorts of different clients. But I think in general, any size portfolio above $10,000, 1/3 allocation in a trade, go for 10 to 20%, have a stop loss that's somewhere around 3 to 5%. As long as you bat 50-50, as long as you win 1 out of every 2, you will grow that account over time.
Nice. Nice. Well, that's a good perspective. I know we've gotten lots of different perspectives, and I think what's important is people take away the fact that there's definitely a right fit for some people, and you need to find what's the best fit for you.
Yeah.
We've got 2 more questions here for you. First of all, what are some, from your perspective, what are some of the personal characteristics that you've had that have allowed you to become successful, not only at trading, but business itself?
I think probably the core reason for my success is that as I got into my, you know, 6th, 7th year of teaching and I realized we didn't have net worth, and then I learned what net worth was, I had an open mind to the future. I started to explore other ways to make money. Some of them were as silly as pulling cans out of the garbage can, and my wife didn't like that idea. Others were bartending and serving tables in between coaching, running camps and clinics, and a roofing business. I got into a pyramid scheme with Amway when they were pitching Quickstar, and I thought, for the first time ever, I was a small business owner. I remember trying to sell my mother paper towels, Bounty paper towels, more expensive than she could buy them at the local like BJ's or Sam's Club. And I was like, Mom, but I'm a business owner. You got to buy these for 100% more cost. But I learned in that process of being open-minded to pulling cans out of garbage cans, getting into Quickstar Amway company and realizing, oh, this isn't a business. They're making their money off of me. But being open to trying different things, and eventually settling on, oh, wow, I could teach people how to trade stocks. I just have to learn how to trade stocks. I could definitely do that well. So I kept an open mind. I tried a lot of things and I moved on from things very quickly that I realized didn't have the upside I was looking for. But by trying one thing after another, I finally ran into something that actually clicked. And you know, it wasn't huge the first year or even the second year. I'm 7 years into this. Sales in excess of $50 million this year. We have excellent profit margins. Probably this is probably a low end estimate, but probably a $100 million company now. We're heading towards the 5,000. It's just blown me away at simply keeping an open mind about everything. And so that's the number one thing that I could share, I think, with people. When I was trying to pay down my debt, just so that we didn't have $250,000 negative net worth, I kept an open mind and started to realize, wow, where could I go to make money faster? This is great pulling cans out of garbage cans or having a quick start business, but this really isn't making me much money. Roofing wasn't going anywhere fast. What could I do? And as I saw where there was a need, and there is a serious need for people who teach quality stock trading education. There's so much misinformation out there, so many smoke and mirror scams out there. I said to myself, I've got to get good at this and I could teach it to thousands of people. And that ended up being true. But if I didn't have an open mind about leaving my teaching career and exploring options, I wouldn't be here right now. And it's not to say that I dislike teaching. I love teaching. I'm still am teaching. It's just to say that I wanted to be rewarded to the upside with my hard work and excellence. And so keeping an open mind and persevering, because I had many, many bad days, horrible trades, just horrible moments in general that I've had to fight through to get to where I am today. And so keeping an open mind and then persevering, it took 7 years. It didn't happen overnight. And I think a lot of people just want that instant gratification. But it started with, I'm going to pay off my JCPenney's $500 credit card because the interest rate is 28%. And Dave Ramsey says that's not good. And now it's grown to where I have no credit score, no credit report. Like, you don't have a credit score if you stop using credit. I haven't used credit for years. I don't ever want to be in debt to banks, credit cards, car loans again. So I buy my house cash, my cars cash. I purchase everything cash, have no credit score. It's not zero. It doesn't exist. All of that happened by just opening my mind to, if I move towards getting out of debt, good things will happen.
The world needs good teachers. And I know we think of teachers like school teachers, but
yeah,
you know, the education system is changing and evolving, and the way that we learn is constantly changing and evolving. And I appreciate the fact that you're an actual school teacher who's providing good to the world and is actually getting paid for it. I mean, most school teachers don't get paid very well, as I mentioned earlier.
Yeah.
And it's like,
yeah, who would have thought I used to be an elementary school teacher making $33,000 a year, and now I'm co-owner of conservatively $100 million company. It goes to show you that your teachers probably are teaching your kids have a lot more value than we assign them.
Yeah.
And monetary value isn't the biggest thing, but it was certainly something that I was after. So I'm glad you brought that up, because I often think back to that. The things that I were teaching were very important. I loved what I was doing, but I wanted more for my family. I went out and got it. And in this business, and you full well know, smoke and mirrors is very popular. So my goal was to be so darn good at trading that nobody could argue how good I was. And over the years, what I realized was the best way to do that is just stream my portfolio to clients live during market hours. Very hard to argue when a client right now of mine who pays me a fee can log in from the phone, tablet, desktop computer, and look at my E-Trade or TD Ameritrade account live. So they watch me win and lose. They start to realize that, wow, real traders do win and lose. And as long as they have a good strategy over time, that equates to a lot of profit. And so by streaming my portfolio live, I feel like I'm hitting my transparency goal. And I'm kind of fighting a trend on Wall Street that is, you know, come up with this great idea that's not really ever been used with real money and pitch it to people to pay tens of thousands of dollars to appeal to their greed and fear, if you will. And so I just try and be real. I'm a base hit trader. I stream my portfolio to clients. They see me win and lose. I've had some bonehead trades in the past that are so embarrassing, Kirk, that I wish it wasn't streaming, because as it's streaming, I'm thinking, my goodness, I can't believe the world's seeing this. You know, I've had to fight through kind of that part of emotional intelligence, that embarrassment of, I can't believe I messed up this bad and everybody's watching it unfold live. And how do I fix it? And often you can't fix it. You just have to take the loss and own it and do a lesson about it. There's no sweeping it under the rug with my stuff. And I think that's why I've built one of the biggest followings. Through the good and the bad, I've simply told the truth. And I think on Wall Street, that's not often the case. And so that right there, that transparency probably is the key to my success being a teacher of stock trading.
And I appreciate that transparency too, because Wall Street definitely doesn't have enough of that. And I think if you haven't made bonehead mistakes, you haven't been trading long enough. That's my experience.
Right. That's so true.
But let me, we got to wrap up here in the interest of time. So I want to ask you one more question, then I'll let you give some final thoughts. So what are some good books that you've read that have really helped craft your investing thinking, or just general books you found have been good for personal improvement?
The book that I read that allowed me to resign my teaching job, you know, and I was 35 when I did that, and I went into the superintendent's office and they questioned if it was a midlife crisis. The book that I had read that gave me the courage to quit my teaching job was Tim Ferriss's 4-Hour Workweek. And specifically the first 4 chapters, he talks about building the courage to do something different in life. I was having a really hard time. It took me over a year to build up the courage to resign my teaching job, even as we were eliminating our debt by paying off loans and whatnot. I was so scared to step out into what I considered to be the real world at the time. I was safe and secure within my teaching ecosystem. 4-Hour Workweek in that first 4 chapters really teaches people to kind of think through, what's the worst case scenario? And if it came true, what could I do? And then what's the best case scenario? I was really more focused on the time at the time, even with $250,000 in negative net worth as I got into all this, I was so focused on everything that could go wrong. And I'm an optimist in life, but it was so scary. So Tim Ferriss's 4-Hour Workweek really helped me. I read The Millionaire Next Door as I was doing Dave Ramsey's Debt Snowball. So Dave Ramsey's Debt Snowball was the key to everything because I was able to eliminate a lot of debt. And in that process, take the risk. My wife carried her teaching job still, so we had some income coming in and I could quit my job and take that risk. So Dave Ramsey's material I found to be invaluable. Then Tim Ferriss's 4-Hour Workweek, kind of first 4 chapters. I would listen to it over and over in my audiobook about what's the worst that could happen and what would I do if it did? And then what's the best that could happen? And as it turns out, the best did happen. Another one that was really good, Think and Grow Rich. I know everybody talks about this, but there's a particular line in there where it says, where he talks about once he learned how to make money, it was a lot easier than he had ever thought. I had it in my mind, be a great stock trader, make millions teaching people how I'm a great stock trader. And that worked out. So my goal was to be good at something and then teach it to others. And I was able to accomplish that. And I realized, wow, when I started to make millions of dollars, I never had it in my mind that all of this would lead to a millionaire, then a multimillionaire in growing this company so big. It just never crossed my mind. So I always tell my clients, whether it's in stock trading or building an internet business or building a brick and mortar business, I don't know what it's going to be for them. But making $1 million isn't nearly as hard as it probably seems, or certainly seemed to me as a school teacher. And that is said very clearly in Think and Grow Rich. Once you figure it out, you realize it wasn't that hard all along. And it seems like such an iffy statement or a wishy-washy statement, but I had no idea how it was going to happen, but I just kept pursuing. And then once it happened, I was like, oh, making $1 million is easy and making millions of dollars is easy. So that book is definitely right with regard to just getting your mindset moving in the right direction. And then once it clicks, it's, oh, wow. And so I'm kind of in that point now. And I didn't know how it was going to happen, but it did. And now I look back and I'm like, ah, all right. Yep. Good book. So those are some of my favorite book recommendations. And they have nothing to do with trading. And the funny part is I've never read a ton of trading books. There's a few that I've read on technical analysis, on Fibonacci trading. The Intelligent Investor, of course, by Graham is a great one. But my whole strategy is really boiled down into emotion. People overreact when a small company has amazing news and it sends the stock screaming higher. And it's in that short period of time that you can make a lot of money inside of a week. And the same thing happens to a downside. Companies have horrible news, overreaction happens, and I can capitalize on overreactions regardless of the direction of the stock. So I have no love for these companies. I just love the fact that small companies, so market caps between 100 million and 2 billion, they fluctuate wildly as a result of good news and horrible news. And in those swings, I make money. It's really a simple strategy, but it's capitalizing on people's emotions.
Jason, this has really been a fascinating conversation and certainly look forward to maybe having you on in the future as well. Where can people find more about you?
RagingBull.com is our umbrella company. So we have about 7 teachers of trading now, all real money traders. They stream their portfolios live. RagingBull.com is where you would find not only me, but the guy who taught me how to trade. Of course, he's been on the show, Jeff Bishop, and a lot of other amazing traders who are teaching their unique strategies as well.
Hey, Money Tree Podcast listeners. We've had a great run over the last 5 years. We've had lots of great guests over that time. Guests like Joe Saul Sehy, Susie Orman, Art Laffer, Burton Malkiel, Peter Schiff, and more. We've had lots of great content, too. Like what happens when somebody steals $500,000 from you? Tax loopholes for the rich. Investing like a billionaire. Why men and women approach investing differently. How to outlive your money. Tax liens, peer-to-peer lending, asset protection, and more. And we've had lots of great questions from you, our audience, as well. And we really appreciate it. But now we need your help. We want to know what you want to listen to. what topics, guests, and content you value most. This is your chance, Money Tree Podcast listeners. We don't ask frequently, but when we do, the door is wide open for you to give us your thoughts, good, bad, and ugly. What do you want to hear more of? What do you want to hear less of? All this helps to make a better show for you. So many of you have already provided your feedback, and it's going to make an exciting 2019 of great content ahead. We're going to be closing the survey soon, so make sure you leave your feedback now. If having a say in your favorite podcast isn't enough, we're also going to be providing monthly promotions to anyone on our email list. The recent promotion was an overwhelming success. We had lots of positive feedback and input from our listeners. We're going to continue to create great shows for you, and they'll be focused on the content that you suggested. Each month, we're going to have a new promotion. We can't tell you now quite what we have in store for you because we want it to be a surprise, but we know that you're going to be excited. We have some special opportunities that money can't buy. We're excited to bring these to you through the year 2019. But in order to qualify for these promotions, we need to hear from you. In order to qualify, you're going to need to sign up for our email list first. When you do, you're going to have an additional chance to win by completing our Money Tree Podcast survey. Go to moneytreepodcast.com/survey2019 to give us your feedback and the additional chance to win. We'll be posting the name of the winner on our website. So if you entered the promotion, please check the website to see that you've won. We also have great shows lined up in the near future with some special guests that you're not going to want to miss. I can't wait to publish these interviews. They're very exciting. So go to moneytreepodcast.com/survey2019 to sign up, and we'll enter you into our monthly promotion. Thanks again for listening, and remember, invest in your life. All right, well, now it's time to move into the panel portion of the show. We have a great panel again. We have Miranda. How's it going, Miranda?
Doing well. How are you?
I'm doing great. Doing maybe half great. The Bruins lost the other night, so doing okay.
Oh, well, you know, this is what happens when you cheer for a team like the Bruins.
Oh, I don't know, Miranda. That hurts.
I have no idea what I'm talking about.
We're going for the triple crown this year.
Low blow.
Good job there, buddy. Good job. It's all you.
Yeah, it is all me. You can blame me for the success and failure of the Bruins.
Exactly.
And also we have Andy Wang. How's it going, Andy?
Going well. I'm the guy who cut cable, so I don't know what's going on in sports or the world.
How do you survive in society nowadays if you don't have cable?
Well, I will tell you this. When everybody is talking about Game of Thrones, I don't know what anybody's talking about. So I'm sort of like living in a vacuum.
Well, I will say I have not watched the news in, I'd say, 20 years. So I get you there, but Game of Thrones, I don't know, man. You're missing out. It was a good show.
No spoilers with me. Listeners do not need to worry.
So call Andy if you have questions.
Exactly.
So great.
So we had Jason Bond on earlier, and we want to talk about some of the topics he discussed, which I think are pretty important. But I guess it's kind of a backdrop so some of the listeners kind of know where we're all coming from. Andy, how do you invest for your clients? Like, what's your philosophy? How do you look at things?
Well, at Runnymede Capital, you know, we tend to be long-term investors. It's usually a blend of stocks and bonds. And if we're talking about stocks, we are typically looking at companies where we feel that the fundamentals are positive, that we look closely at earnings. So we want to find companies that are growing their earnings consistently with the idea that the stock price should follow. And we'll combine that with some low-cost ETFs for additional diversification. But yeah, we're long-term investors for our clients.
So you'd say you're more of a fundamental investor?
It's a combo. I mean, we look at both. We want to understand the fundamentals so that there's some underpinning for our portfolio positioning. But we'll look at technicals too, because the technicals will give you just a better sense of timing, like what's happening right now. If you're only looking at fundamentals, you could believe that things look great, but stock prices keep going down. So we look at a combination of both so that we have some sense of like market psychology, where stock prices, where the movement is going, but we look at the fundamentals too so that we can explain the movement up or down.
Nice. And what about you, Miranda? What's your preferred way to invest?
As lazily as possible. I do definitely a long-term kind of view. I'm an indexer, as many of our listeners know. So, you know, my preferred method of investing is just indexing, choosing broad-based index funds, bond funds, stock funds, and then also REITs. I do add REITs in there to have some of that real estate exposure. My retirement portfolio is, of course, heavily weighted, well, retirement with like air quotes, the money I have in my tax advantaged accounts that I can't touch till after 59 and a half. I like to say, you know, it's like, I don't plan on retiring from my life anytime soon. So the stuff that's in like those retirement accounts is heavily weighted towards stocks. I don't need it for a while. I do have investing in I have a travel fund and I keep that in a taxable investment account. And that is divided up with 77% stocks and 23% bond funds. You know, it's a little bit less aggressive, but it's still a fairly aggressive position. And it's grown enough. I mean, it's how I was able to go on a Viking River cruise with my son a couple years ago and like using that kind of investing. So I just sort of see it as like, okay, I've got my goals and how do I put my money to work to help me reach my goals, whether it's short-term travel or whether it's long-term building some wealth for the future. And so, you know, my kind of view is trying to make sure that where I'm putting my money to work is helping me achieve the kind of lifestyle I want and to reach my goals.
Yeah, and I think it's great we have different perspectives here on this because I think from the listener's perspective, everyone has a different way to invest. I mean, Miranda's is a very common way for people to invest. And for a lot of people, it's a great way. I certainly have a different opinion, but I found over the years that there's no single best way to invest. There's only a best way to invest for you, right? So Miranda's approach wouldn't work for me because I have a different perspective of investing. And my approach probably wouldn't work for her because we're all kind of wired in our own way. And
I think you put way too much work into your investing.
Yes, I do. Yes.
Yeah. So tell us about that though, Kirk. Tell us about that because I mean, you know, you've asked Andy and myself, you know, our theories on it or how we go about it. How do you go about it for yourself and for your clients? How do you go about choosing investments?
My approach is, I guess I would call it more tactical based. You know, similar to Andy, we combine the fundamental with the technical. Like, I don't think there's one that's better than the other. I think it's each has their purpose and you need to use them for their purpose. Like, some people only use technical or only use fundamental, which, you know, I think you're kind of missing out on some additional stuff there. But the way that I look at it is, and the way I kind of describe it is, most people like modern portfolio theory. And this is how kind of Wall Street has constructed things, is diversify, reduce your risk. And, you know, that's kind of like driving down the street and seeing a boulder in front of you and hitting it and just saying, well, the boulder was there. You get thrown from your car, you get back in your car and you keep driving. Well, the assumption is that there's going to be ups and downs in the market, which we all know exist. And I'm sure there's going to be a down streak coming soon. But, you know, I look at it and say, well, why hit the boulder? You know, why not drive around it? So we take a lot more tactical approach to investing. We focus on risk management first, which is don't lose money. So, you know, we're not the people you come to if you want to outperform the index every single year and try to get astronomical returns, because that's not what we do. You know, what we do is focus on consistently growing wealth and managing risk. You know, we do that through different methodologies, but what, you know, I've found some that work for me. So we hedge risk, we define it. So we know that the market could drop 50% and the most you might lose, for an example. This is totally, actually, I'm not even going to use that. I'll probably get into trouble. So, but let's just say we can define it to the penny exactly what that would be. So we look at things a little bit differently from the traditional side, which is what most people do, and kind of what we're talking about here. That's how we look at the traditional side. But of course, we have alternative investments that we look at too, which is a whole nother animal, which is, you know, from my perspective, and this is why really we started the firm, was a lot of people focus on traditional assets and you're missing this whole other realm of investments out there. Like Miranda, you mentioned real estate. If I wanted to invest in a rental property down the street, we can do that. Why would I have to invest in a REIT if I know that this property is a really good investment? So we don't limit ourselves to the traditional side. We also invest in alternatives for clients.
you know, real estate being the most popular, but private company stock, tax liens, cryptocurrencies. Tim does that at our firm. Gold. I mean, it's really, we don't put limitations on investments. What we really focus on is this a good investment? That's the first criteria we look at. And it's not what asset class it falls in, or, you know, it has to fit in a certain bucket. Is it a good investment? If it is, then we break it down and we look at it as from a risk management perspective. So that's kind of how we look at it. You know, it's kind of a roundabout way to describe it, but that's kind of how we look at investing. One thing I wanted to ask both of you is Wall Street has made a lot of money kind of crafting this opinion of how things should be. And there's, through that positioning of from a marketing perspective, it's created a lot of myths and I guess misconceptions when it comes to trading or investing. Miranda, what are some of the myths that you've seen that people misunderstand or take the wrong way, and maybe it can be, you know, hazardous to their investing portfolio?
Well, honestly, the two biggest myths that I run into in, you know, my own personal life are it's hard to get started and I have to have a lot of money. For a lot of people, they honestly believe that if they don't have $10,000 that they can just invest like right now, they don't have enough money to invest. And so I think that's detrimental because the idea that it's hard to get started and the idea that you have to have a lot of money, and to a lot of regular people, $10,000 is a lot of money. These two myths hold them back from getting started, which means that they are missing out on time in the market. They are missing out on compounding returns. They are missing out on opportunities to put their money to work for them. And so those are the two biggest things that I run into most of the time. And you know, I tell people, well, if you have $100 a month that you can contribute, you can invest in Betterment. If you have pocket change, you can use something like Acorns or Robinhood or Wise Banyan. You know, if you have $5 these days, you can start investing. You know, and it doesn't have to be hard. If you choose a broad-based index fund or use one of these robo-advisors that focus on broad-based index funds and their asset allocations, then you can get started without a whole lot of trouble. And then once you start putting that money to work for you, that's when you can go out and start doing the hard things like, well, let's figure out what makes a good investment. Let's educate myself. Let's, you know, move forward. But I think for a lot of people, just that getting started thing, overcoming that hurdle is the hardest thing.
Yeah, that's great, Miranda, because I mean, that applies to real estate as well. I mean, I've found over the years, I mean, real estate's really hard to do in the same way. It's just such a big jump from going from zero to one. So Andy, what are your thoughts? What are some common big myths that you know of or misconceptions that people have about investing?
Well, I think that one big myth is that trading is easy. I mean, the allure is there, right? It's like walking by a casino and you see like the crap table or you see people playing blackjack and you say, oh, that looks easy and fun. And look, that guy has a pile of money. You know, since Jason Bond was talking about trading, and I love what you said about each person has to figure out what's the right approach for him or her. And there's no right or wrong way to do this. Like you can invest just in commodities. You could invest in futures. You can invest in stocks and bonds. And I think the operative word for Miranda is that I love her lazy approach. For her, less is more. Kirk, I think your and my approach for our clients is very similar because we're trying to control and limit risk, whether it's like at the security level, at the sector level, or the portfolio level. And we're trying to figure out what is the client's goal and then put the pieces together so that the portfolio matches their goals and what they need to do. And if we can protect them from a severe market downturn, we sleep better at night, our clients sleep better at night. And we've seen through financial crises that when you have big financial losses, it can impact your health in a negative way. So I think just like it's important for people to know that it's good to do homework and trading is not that easy. It doesn't come so simply. But anybody can play, right? As Miranda was saying, people should not be put off saying that this is hard to do and they just should never approach investing at all. That is not the case. But if you're going to approach it, you do need to define what is your approach. Are you going to do a lazy approach, which works really well, or are you going to be active, which is more like Jason's approach, trading. He's swing trading. So that's the polar opposite, I would say, of what Miranda's doing. He's day trading or week trading by the week and really trying to take advantage of moves in these small cap companies.
Yeah. And I think your point there is, you know, figure out what your approach should be, figure out what's going to work with you. And one of the reasons I like to tell people to start with indexing is because you don't have to think about it a lot. So you could get the money in there and then learn about these other things and really develop your own style. And then once you have that figured out and that approach figured out, then you can move your money out of those index funds, put that money someplace else, put it to work in a different way, however works for you. But yeah, I mean, definitely figuring out your own style, I think, is huge.
Yeah. And it's one thing that I know from my perspective, I've got a few thoughts on this. And one of them is, I think Andy, you had mentioned this, but it's the need to be invested 100% of the time. One of the biggest myths that I've seen that I have to say really annoys me, but it's so prevalent in terms of a concept that everyone feels like they need to be invested 100% of the time. And there are Wall Street firms, there's like a famous PowerPoint slide where they say, well, if you missed the top performing 5 days, you would have missed out on 15% return or whatever the numbers are. And I look at that and say, well, what if you missed the bottom three worst performing days? You would have performed X amount better too. Like, you know, they take statistics and they put them out there and it sounds good as a selling tool. But the myth that you need to be invested 100% of the time is harmful in many ways. Because, you know, if you look at 2008, for example, you had a year to prepare for 2008. Like the writing was on the wall. People were talking about it. It was a surprise to a lot of people. So I don't want to undercut that. But the point is like, it wasn't like you just woke up one day and it was down 50%. There was a lot of discussion around it. And, you know, if you're not comfortable in the market, then don't invest. Invest into something else that you are comfortable with. But, you know, when people think that if I'm not in the market, I'm going to be losing out, it's, you know, it's a false choice. Like, it's just, you need to do what you're comfortable with. You need to invest with a style that you're comfortable with. You know, you're not going to be Warren Buffett. Warren Buffett is Warren Buffett. Like, if you can invest like that, that's great. But you shouldn't try to just because he's one of the best investors in our lifetime. It doesn't mean that you should do that, because you're not going to get the same returns unless it so happens that that's how you invest. And even he doesn't do that. Even he doesn't have all his money in the market all the time. You know, like, he has cash built up for opportunities. And so I think it's just finding a style, as we're talking here, finding a style that works for you, that you feel comfortable with and doesn't make you feel uneasy. Because emotions are the biggest problem that we face in investing or trading or otherwise. It's, you know, we're emotional beings and emotions control us. That's your biggest enemy. The markets aren't your enemy. It's your emotions. So if you can fight your emotions or get them under control, you'll be a much better investor for it. And finding an investing style that works with your emotional stability, I'll call it, is probably the best one for you. What do you guys think about being a trader as a full-time business, or as Jason was doing, and there are many other people who do this, they're full-time traders. Actually, we had one on a number of months ago as well, where earlier in his career, he traded full-time. But what are your thoughts, Andy?
I'm concerned for the full-time traders, because it's not for the faint of heart. I think I mentioned before that in my career, right, in my 20-plus year career, I've known professional traders, I've known investment like advisors and long-term investors. If I can generalize with a broad brush stroke, the long-term investors tend to outlive the full-time traders, because trading is just a lot more volatility. It's more short-term. And I think that the advent of computerized trading and algorithmic trading, the humans are now battling machines. And to some extent, you're losing some of the advantages that you once had. And things are moving so quickly that to be a full-time trader trading every day, there's a possibility that that's going to wear on you. It's not an easy job.
Yeah, no, I would agree with that. From my experience, as well as people I know that do this full-time, it is definitely something not for the faint of heart. What about you, Miranda?
Well, we all know it's way too much work for me to get involved with. So, yeah, I mean, it feels like, I mean, there's a lot of work. And then the other thing is you have to have this really strong stomach. You know, when you're day trading, when you're doing these things, you have to be prepared to lose $10,000 in a day and go back out there and hope to make $20,000 or $30,000 the next day. So when you're trading in this sort of environment, you have to have that kind of strong stomach and accept that sometimes you're going to have a big loss, like a massive loss. And day to day, I mean, it could be tens of thousands of dollars, and you have to have that iron stomach.
Yeah, and that's actually a great point. I've interviewed a famous trader recently on the show, and we have a few more in the pipeline that we're lining up. But if you interview these top people, and if you listen to interviews from other places as well, you'll realize like it sounds good in the advertisements, like, hey, you can make 100% on this trade. But the reality is that you can do that, and you can also lose 100% on a trade. And it's not just about a single trade, right? It's not just about, hey, I just made 100%. Well, great. What are you going to do tomorrow? What are you going to do in the next trade? It's a process. It's a lifestyle if you're doing this professionally. And it's a lot about balancing risk. You know, like you don't put all your money in one trade. You balance it about between many trades. So while one may gain 100%, maybe that's only 1% of your portfolio. So great, you just made 1% on your portfolio, not 100%. And the good traders, they know they're going to lose. You know, there's a win and lose percentage. They know that they're going to win, whatever, 60% of the time. And if they calculate their numbers correctly, then that turns into a good performance for them. But, you know, they're not going in blind assuming that like, oh yeah, we're just going to make lots of money because this is easy, because it's not easy. If you're doing it as a full-time business, forget the tax consequences, which are a whole nother ball of wax. You know, if you're doing this professionally, the tax consequences are also a piece of this, and there's good and bad parts of that. But really, it's just kind of understanding what you're getting into as a full-time trader, because it's, as Andy said, from a stress and a health perspective, you got to be built for this, and it's not for everybody. There's some people who are really good at it. They're built for it, and it's great. You know, if you're looking for action, which I would say is another thing that we see a lot, is people who just want action. They want to trade. They want to do something. Sometimes the best thing to do is nothing. It's not necessarily to do a trade. So I would just say just kind of understand what you're getting into before you do. So what are some tools that each of you use maybe to control your emotions? Because I think we all acknowledge emotions are a part of trading. What about you, Miranda?
One of the nice things about indexing is it really takes the emotion out of it. Most of the time, the most emotion I feel is this crashing low enough for me to take my extra money and bargain hunt? So that's mostly the emotion that I feel a lot of the time with the stock markets. A lot of the time with the emotion part of it, indexing pretty much takes the emotion out of just about everything. Because like you said, I mean, the assumption is I am going to hit that boulder at some point. The market is going to go down and I have to ride it out and wait for it to rise again. And if I have to sell some of my assets, like I did in 2010, when my basement flooded, I actually tapped into a taxable investment account I was using for my long-term emergency fund. And I ended up taking a loss, but it turns out that made my flooded basement a tax-deductible event, because then I could deduct the losses from my taxes. So looking at it that way also helps, is because I take a look at it and say, is the money accomplishing what I need it to? So if there comes to a point where I take the money out of my travel fund during a down market, so I take the shares that I liquidate to go on a trip or whatever, if I have to liquidate them at a low point, I just remind myself that now my vacation is tax deductible, because I ask myself, is the money accomplishing what I want it to accomplish? Is it serving its purpose? Well, its purpose is to have capital available for me to go on a trip. So yes, it served its purpose. And now it's also tax deductible because the market is down. On the flip side of that, when I did take my trip, our Viking River cruise, the investments had appreciated. So I actually had some capital gains that I had to pay on it. But the amount that I liquidated was small enough that the capital gains tax wasn't a huge deal. And it was certainly affordable. So I just reminded myself of that. But yeah, a lot of it just has to do with, is the money serving the purpose that I want it for? And as long as it is, then I manage to feel okay about things.
Well, that's great. It sounds like you've got that under control, Miranda. your emotional intelligence when it comes to investing, it sounds like you're better than like 99% of the people out there.
It might be different someday, I guess. I don't know if like there's a huge stock market event just before I like decide I need a large amount of money during retirement or something. Maybe things will change. But right now, as long as it's doing what I expect it to do and I have the money available for what I want, I really don't care.
I like that. Very zen. You sound very zen.
It sounds like you're emotionally prepared for big events too, which I think is an important thing to consider, right? I
mean, right. And you have to be ready because we, as humans, psychologically, we tend to get in these biases that say what is happening now will keep happening. And the stock market's mostly going up. We're in this long bull run. Of course, it's going to keep going up. No, it's not. And it's going to be ugly when it crashes next. I mean, this 500-600 point thing means nothing when we're talking about Dow 26,000. Like 500 points means nothing. And so I'm prepared for that. I'm like, I know this is going to happen. And the only thing that kind of bums me out is that we've had this artificially inflated stock market for the last 2 years. And I'm like, I really would like it to crash in the next 6 months to a year so that by the time my son goes to college and I need to get into his 529, it's in recovery mode. So I'd really like it to benefit me if it could.
Yeah. What about you, Andy? What are some tools that you use to control your emotions?
It's important to recognize the difference between the trading and the investing. Like if you're holding it for a day or a week, or if you're planning to hold a position for 20 years, I mean, it's very different. I think with trading, it tends to be much more speculative. In some cases, you don't even care what it is that you're trading. You're just looking at a stock chart. You're trying to analyze a pattern and you're going to buy or you're going to sell. For us as longer term investors, I think that doing one's homework is critical. The more homework you do, the better understanding you do, then you can have some conviction and that takes some of the emotion out. So it's like you do your homework, you're trying to control risk on the security level. So if you're buying a company, you want to understand what's going on at that company, who's managing the company, what is their growth plan for the next 3 to 5 years, what are the growth drivers that are factors in generating their earnings and their revenue growth, and what are the concerns that are out there for that company. And if you're going to own that company, you understand those things, you are making an educated and informed decision when you're buying that stock. You're not making a rash decision. So in that way, I'm trying to remove emotion. And then as you own more than just one thing, you're diversifying. So you own different sectors, you own different industries, and you put a portfolio together. And then again, the whole thing comes together so that it's an informed, educated process. And you're not making shooting from the hip and just, you feel good today, you feel bad tomorrow. And you're making investment decisions based on that. I think it's more about methodology. It's trying to understand, it's like security level, portfolio level. And then I think, Kirk, you, like us, we also look at the overall economy and we're looking sort of top down too to see what is the overall market risk, because that should drive the portfolio mix. Like how aggressive are you going to be? Or are you going to be defensive? You know, it's like putting a finger to the wind and trying to figure out what is the weather forecast. That's what we're trying to do too. And that's all part of trying to remove emotion, because we want to make informed decisions, not emotional ones.
Yeah, and I think you raised some good points, Andy, because when you look at investing or an investment, you can't just look at it in this petri dish of here's all that matters, right? You can't just say, well, the fundamentals are all that matters or the technicals. You have to kind of tie all these things in together, right? Like you do a lot of fundamental research to make sure that it's a good investment. You look at technicals for the entry and exit. And then just like we do, like look at the macro economy, like the global economy, and say, all right, where are the bigger trends? Because you could invest in the best buggy whip company, but if it's the last one and the trend is down, then it's probably not a good investment. You know, I think you're right. We look at investing in the same way, that you have to look at all these different pieces as a whole and, you know, see where the bigger trends are and then invest. And we do it top down. So we start from like the bigger trends and then we dive in deeper into the individual stuff. I mean, for us in controlling our emotions, I would say over the years, I've evolved my strategy. I mean, one of them is really understanding yourself well. So I've spent a lot of time in understanding my own kind of investor intelligence, emotional intelligence, if you will, of understanding like where my strengths and weaknesses are as an investor, because we all have them. And for me, like, I know that there are certain pieces that are hard. We stopped using stop losses because it was challenging to keep them, because traditionally you put a stop loss on, you put the trade on and you wait and it gets triggered and then you're out and you don't have to worry about it. But then, you know, I think it was close to 8 years ago, there were swings of 10% plus like 20 times through in 1 year. Like, it was a crazy year with a lot of volatility and stop losses were useless. And everybody I knew was getting stopped out like every other week. So you couldn't put them on, and it was hard to hold them on the books and hold them in my mind, if you will, and just say, all right, now we got to get out. Because you always rationalize, oh, it's going to go back, it's going to do this. So what I found was I can't do it that way. So we use options as a substitute way to do that. So it allows us to define our risk and manage our risk in a very precise way, which gets into one of the tools of investing, of knowing, and this is, I find to be really helpful for me, and I think for a lot of other people, is before you get into a position or into an investment, of knowing what your exit strategy is and when you're going to get out and why. For instance, if you're investing in a stock, I look at it and say, if it goes down more than 10%, I'm out. That's it. I'm out. Hard and fast rule. And if it goes up 30%, let's say, then I'm going to get out, or I'm going to cut my position in half or something like that. You have to have rules in place ahead of time, because if you don't, then in the moment, you will tend to come up with many, many reasons why you should change your mind in the moment, which of course is always an emotional decision. So I find that writing down before I invest exactly why I'm investing, what the thesis is, when I'm going to get out, what are the reasons I would get out. So for instance, going down 10% may not be a reason, but maybe they're selling solar panels. If the thesis is that they're going to continue selling solar panels and they change their business model to sell wind farms, maybe I'm going to get out of that position, right? So understanding why you're investing in it, and if that thesis changes, it just causes you to go back to the well to reevaluate it, or just get out and you can always come back. You know, or even on the upside of saying that this position will go up 30%, and when it does, I'm going to do X.
Kirk, you're an experienced guy. So it's great that you have like a good sense of your own EQ and how that integrates into your investing. But do you have tools to help you measure your clients where they are, because each individual is different? And then maybe it can give the listener today some insight into how can they reflect and look at themselves and say, can I determine where I am on a scale?
I think this will probably be the first time in my life I've called myself a tool, but you know,
it's usually other people.
Yeah, it's usually other people calling us that. But I would say, Andy, you and I are a tool. Our role is to help our clients through these emotional parts of investing. Because many clients out there, or many investors out there, some of them want to do it themselves, in which case they have to have this emotional intelligence internally. They have to find methodologies. I'm telling you mine, the ways I go about it, because it works for me. That may not work for everybody. But I think that if you're doing it yourself, you have to come up with your own methodologies. Part of our role as advisors is to remove that emotion from the investing. It's to take that on our shoulders, and that burden is kind of on us to do that for our clients. So in many ways, that is in itself a tool for investors to use. It doesn't mean that the investors that are using advisors don't get emotional or aren't involved, and there are times where the market is really quite crazy, right? You know, the market's volatile. I mean, the fourth quarter of last year, people were kind of losing their minds and wondering if we were in the next recession. And that's normal. Like, that's normal behavior. And part of our role as advisors is to help our clients through those times. I've talked to a lot of people over the years that in 2008, they sold at the bottom and they wouldn't get back in all the way up. They couldn't do it. They're like, I can't go through that again. You know, if they had had an advisor to help them, like if you've already lost the money, you know, the downside is kind of low at that point. But I think it's hard because people get into this kind of a shell shock mentality where they can't operate because they're frozen. They have an inability to make decisions at that point, which is many ways harmful to their own investing. So I would say we're probably one of the better tools to do that. And certainly I could ask you the question too, Andy. I mean, I think we both have internal tools that we use that may not apply to individual investors, but each of our clients is different. And for me, like I know each of my clients, I know what their risk tolerance is. I know why it's not just a number for us. Like I know why it's an issue. Some person might say, well, on a 1 to 10 scale, it might be a 5, but I know that if this happens, it's really going to be a problem for the investor, whereas it might not be a problem for anyone else. So for me personally, it's knowing each client inside and out and understanding how they look at investing so that I can more accurately work with them to manage that process through volatile times. So I don't know, do you have any tools, Andy, that you use for this?
I agree with that. I think even when you have tools, you try to assign a number, but in like extreme times, it all goes out the window because people will tell you, oh, I'm a 6, but then the market is down 20% and suddenly they're a 1. You know what I mean? It's a moving target. So, no doubt, the advisor role is to understand where is the client at right now, and you hope to be a voice of reason for them and their money just to keep them on track.
So I think it's an important point you raise, and I want to make a definite point of this, is that when we assess clients for their risk, if you're assessing them today, and let's say, I don't know what the market's doing today, but let's say that it's normal, right? That we have a slow climb up in the stock market, and their expectations are normalized. They're not fearful. And, you know, they might just say rank a 6, right? But when the market crashes, now they're ranking a 1. And any time that someone is assessing their risk through an advisor or even on their own, you have to be mindful of the fact that it's going to be based on a time frame, on a point in time. And that will change all the time based on when you're taking it. And as an individual investor, if you're doing it yourself, you have to be mindful of the fact that where you are in that spectrum. And part of our role, like Andy, you, I know you do the same thing. Like part of our role is to understand where the client should be and needs to be versus where they are today. Like I've had people come in and say, I'm very conservative. I just want 20% a year. I was like, great, show me your investing platform. I'd love to invest with you. Like if you're of low risk and 20% a year, that's phenomenal, but that's not realistic. Or vice versa. Some people say they're aggressive and they're okay with like 3 or 4%. So a lot of this is assessing kind of a realistic expectations for them in that way. So yeah, I definitely agree with you, Andy.
Kirk, we're dominating. I think Miranda and her son went on a cruise again.
That travel fund's being spent.
Hey, it's what it's there for, man.
Well, before we go for a permanent vacation on the show, let's have a final question here. Miranda, what books would you recommend for investing, trading, or even just good books for people who want to get their mind in the right place for this?
Yeah, so one of my favorite books, it's called The Oblivious Investor, and it's by a friend of mine, Mike Piper. It's just this like short little book. It's less than 100 pages. And it's just about indexing and how to get started in indexing and, you know, how to enjoy oblivion as you do so. So anyway, but it's called The Oblivious Investor. It's about blocking out the noise, blocking out the media sensationalism that sometimes accompanies reporting on the markets, and really just creating a plan and sticking to it. So I really like that. And then The Good Old Common Sense Investing, The Little Book of Common Sense Investing by John Bogle is another great one that I really like because, you know, he talks about indexing and index funds and just this basic measure of getting started and using index funds. I mean, you know, John Bogle is the father of the index fund. So of course, I'm going to recommend. So he has quite a few books, but if you're going to choose one of John Bogle's books, I mean, the classic, The Little Book of Common Sense Investing, is a great one.
Nice. Those are great. I love the little books of common sense investing. There's a lot of little books out there. They're great. They're bite-sized portions for people to grab onto. What about you, Andy? What are your top thoughts on books?
Well, I think, you know, for some entertaining and educational reading, I like Michael Lewis's Flash Boys and The Big Short. Those are two books that can really give you some insight into the financial crisis and what's going on with like computer trading today. But then for investing, I guess to diversify from Jack Bogle's indexing, one of the first books that I read was One Up on Wall Street, which is Peter Lynch's approach to investing. And the focus is really on invest in what you know, keep your eyes open. It's like, what items are you buying? What stores are you supporting? What products or retailers do you really like right now? And if you're buying at an early stage, those are companies that can continue to grow for a long time. And as an investor, those are the types of companies that you want to own, because you can really grow your money. And it's a beautiful thing, right? That's why we love investing, because when you buy the right companies or you buy the right index or ETF, you can make money while you sleep. And that is fantastic.
That's great. You know, one of my favorite books that I love recently about investing is called The Outsiders, 8 Unconventional CEOs and Their Radically Rational Blueprint for Success. And what it is, it talks about these individual stocks that over the years have drastically outperformed the market. And they go into analysis of why they outperformed. Of course, Warren Buffett's in there, for all you Buffett followers will love that. But it's a great insight into the CEOs and the importance of these different companies. And the reason that they were successful is not always the same, which is really the fascinating part. But the theme is very similar. So I highly recommend that book for anybody who's really interested in individual stocks. Personally, I read a lot about things like emotional intelligence, because I think that we can all do better at that. There's so many good books out there, it's really hard to choose. I would say those are really what I'm reading right now. I'd suggest The Outsiders. So final thoughts, Miranda, where can people find out more about you?
Yeah, just head on over to plantingmoneyseeds.com. I have a resources page where you can get a list of the different websites I use to manage my money, the apps that I use to put my money to work for me in a way that I prefer.
Great. And what about you, Andy?
Oh, thanks. People can find me at runnymede.com. That's R-U-N-N-Y-M-E-D-E. We're fee-only investment advisors, helping people to do retirement planning, financial planning, managing their money. And then to the podcast listener, if you have room on your podcast app, you can also find me at Inspired Money, where I talk to different guests about inspirational things that they're doing with their money.
Awesome. Well, thanks for both coming on the show. My name is Kirk Chisholm, wealth manager at Innovative Advisory Group, also host here at Money Tree Investing Podcast. At Innovative Advisory Group, we don't just manage your wealth, we make your life better. So you can find out more about me at innovativewealth.com. You can find me on all the traditional social media channels. Thank you all for joining us this week on Money Tree Investing Podcast. Please remember to subscribe to the podcast on iTunes, Apple Podcasts, Spotify, Stitcher, and Google Play. You can also check out our show at moneytreepodcast.com. On our website, you'll have access to all the resources, show notes, and archive shows. Lastly, please subscribe to our show on iTunes and give us a rating, as well as comments and your thoughts. When you subscribe and rate to the show, it really helps us get better access to some of the top guests that you're really going to want to hear. Have a great week ahead. And remember, no one will care about your money like you do. So invest in your life.
Thank you for listening to the Money Tree Investing Podcast. Visit us at moneytreepodcast.com for more free investing resources.